Hello and welcome to Fantasy Talks Live, the podcast that came out of the Jose's Amazing World's YouTube channel. Original video recordings of all the episodes in the podcast can be found at Jose's Amazing World's in YouTube. Listeners beware, as plot spoilers can be discussed in any of the episodes in the podcast. And now, without further delay, enjoy the show.
And it's that awkward moment where apparently we are live. So if anyone's watching, welcome and hello. And if not, you catch you later on the replay. I am joined today by Derry, Queen of the Otherlings herself, to discuss and spoil the hell out of the Lightship Traders, which is the second trilogy in the Realm of the Otherlings series by Robin Hood, but I didn't need to say that.
No, you did, because some people do try and read it first and stab me in the heart when they do
right.
that.
Right. Well, without jumping ahead, but that sort of, because we talked about kind of something like that last time.
Yeah.
But, so here's my first question to you, right? Presumably, if you're like me, you read the Farseer trilogy. So you started at the beginning.
Yeah.
And you got so in love with the Fitz and the Fool characters that you attempted to skip Lightship Traders because it doesn't feature those two characters. And you just want to get to know more about them and what's going on with them. And you don't want a trilogy in between that has got nothing to do with them.
Yeah.
Now, I did a bit of browsing around the internet and I decided to read Lightship Traders, which is absolutely the right thing to do. So why is that the right thing to do?
Well, partly because all of the Realm of the Elderlings, like any big fantasy series, builds on each other. So if you miss a big chunk at the beginning, there will be things later that don't really make sense because you didn't get the grounding for it. These characters are going to come back. The situation that we get in Lightship Traders, because that's what we're getting in Lightships, we're not getting the life story of characters. We're getting a lot of characters, but it's not their story, really. They're just telling us the story of a time and an event and a situation that we need to know about to move forward with Fitz. And not getting that leaves a really big gap in your knowledge moving forward. You're going to feel the lack of it if you haven't read it moving forward. And, massive spoiler alert, there is a major character who is in Lightship Traders. And if you haven't caught that moment of development in that character, you're going to be very lost with some of the emotional beats in Tawny Man. You need to have seen what happened in the intervening years. So, yeah, you do have, I know it's hard moving away from Fitz. I know. And a lot of people wait a long time to read Lightships because it's not Fitz, but they know they shouldn't move past Lightships to get back to Fitz. So they just wait ages because they don't want to read not Fitz.
Yeah. And
it's well worth it.
And I have to say, I found it overall a better told story, a better trilogy than Farseer. So I think, which is why, obviously, you are going to disagree, but Lightship works really well on its own.
Yeah, so, absolutely.
Which is why, conceivably, some people may want to begin with Lightship Traders and then go back to Farseer.
Yeah.
Because if you want to give Robin Hobb a try, Lightship Traders, it just works better in every sense. As a story, the development, the ending of it, the character, everything in Lightship is better than in Farseer. Is that a fair assessment?
Mostly.
Because we talked last time about how the ending of Farcia felt a little bit rushed.
Yeah.
And it only makes sense when you've read more in the series that you go, oh, I see why the ending was kind of that quick and that rushed.
Yeah.
And some people may kind of stop there. But Liveship is just, it's a much more well-crafted, solid story from beginning to end.
And this, I have said, and I stand by it, Liveships is a fabulous standalone trilogy. If you're not going to read The Realm of the Elderlings, if 16 books is just too many books and you just don't want to do that, and you only really have the energy to read 3 Robin Hobb books, read The Liveship Traders. Absolutely. It works as a standalone. It doesn't work as an entry point to Realm of the Elderlings. So if you think that you're going to want to read Realm of the Elderlings, don't start at Liveships. You need to start at Farseer. And the reason is more that very early on in Liveships, you learn that some really basic assumptions that are made in Farseer aren't correct. And that's not to say that they're wrong necessarily. They're just on a different wavelength. But if you already know the things that you learn in Liveships and you read Farseer, it can feel like a complete waste of time because they seem to be chasing a red herring for all of the 3 books. And you're not going to get the same satisfaction as if you went into Farseer first. And then you get a story that's satisfying, it reaches an end, fabulous. Then you read Liveships and go, they had the wrong end of the stick. And it's more interesting. But when you do it the wrong way around, you're just going, what are they doing? They're wrong. Mm-hmm. So you're just taking away from your own enjoyment of the series if you try and start with Liveships. So yes, it is a better contained trilogy, but it shouldn't be read first.
Yeah. It's just that it's very hard to know whether you're going to enjoy a really long series like this one. You know, when I keep talking about it, but when I did Wheel of Time, obviously you don't know whether you're going to like something or not. The problem with Wheel of Time is that it's not compartmentalized in different trilogies. It's their overall thing, and then I plowed through it. And the good thing, I suppose, about Elderlings is that it is compartmentalized. And you could sort of pick the first trilogy and then leave it if you wanted, or sort of get to... I suppose there are different drop-off points.
You can stop after each set because each set ends and then there's a time gap. None of it's consecutive. Like it's not like you start at day one and it just keeps going at the same rate. It doesn't. There's one set of events in Farseer and then there's a gap. There's 7 years between the end of Farseer and the beginning of Liveships. So if you take a break, it kind of works because it has to catch you up anyway as to what happened in the intervening time. And again, after Liveships, there's another 5, 6, 7 years between the end of Liveships and the beginning of Tawnyman. So even if you finish Liveships and go, okay, that was actually a lot and I'm quite happy with where that ended, it doesn't matter if it takes you a few years to come back and pick up Tawnyman, because by this stage, you haven't seen Fitz in his world for 15 years. It feels okay to come back after a big gap because he's aged. Whereas so many series, if you drop off, you kind of have to reread a whole heap to get back into the swing. And you kind of don't need to with Realm of the Elderlings. You can take it in chunks and let it take its time.
So I said before, I think we both agreed that it is a better story from Farseer. So what are the things that are done better in Liveship compared to the first trilogy? Because I think some things are still equally bad, or as bad, because it's not perfect. But
that's heresy.
I'll talk about it later. But what? So, I think, as usual, with the exception of your antagonist, Robin Hobb's character work is second to none. And in here, I call this her feminist trilogy. Like all yep. our main protagonists are, we follow a family of
yep.
a family of traders through the eyes of the women in the family. So we've got the grandmother, yep. who is your kind of archetypal stay at home yep. sort of.
She's absolutely a matriarch of the family. Yeah,
that's right. She's the one raising the children and being the stay at home wife to the trader husband. Then you've got the mother of the two girls that we follow, who is kind of caught in between, sort of that middle generation. And then we've got the daughters who actually want to go out into the world and be like their husbands or brothers and become traders of their own right. and so we've got that sort of cross-generation take on women. So
yeah.
She does that.
She does. I mean, you've got, as you say, you've got the matriarch, Ronica, and she's kept the onshore side of their family business afloat through all of the years her husband has been trading. You've got her daughters, Kefria and Althea. Kefria, we don't get a POV from until quite a lot later in the books, but we do get a point of view from Kefria. And Althea is one of our major point of view characters. And her relationship with both her sister and her mother is really quite spectacularly explored. And Kefria's daughter, Althea's niece, Aunt Malta, is our fourth female character that we have a lot of time with. And as protagonists go, yes, it is a very feminist story. And yet I don't feel that in any way takes away from the seriousness of the events, or if anything, it just adds a layer that we're also going to discuss the fact that their actions and their thoughts are so limited or determined by their interactions with the men who run their world. And that whether that it makes it more difficult or easier, or how they have to navigate that. One of the absolute strengths in Live Ships is this is where we meet all of Hobbes' best antagonists. This is where you get bad guys you can hate, like really hate.
Yeah. Okay, I'm going to disagree with you on that point. But just to
please do, because I want to argue with you if you don't agree with me there.
just to take it back for a second, and when I say her feminist trilogy, I don't mean it in this third generation feminism thing going on, because Robin Hobb hasn't taken a female protagonist and basically just turned into a man.
No.
And she just got a woman doing traditional male hero roles in fantasy. No. She has a full understanding of the differences between men and women, and yep. and she is just basically being very realistic about what it would be to take a woman and put her in a male-dominated environment, like a sailing boat, and all the yep. problems and all the issues that could arise from that. It's not a tokenistic female protagonist.
No, like not at all.
She's gone full on with all the consequences of what it would mean to put a woman in such an environment. And I think it's refreshing. I mean, obviously the books were written quite a few years ago, but it is refreshing to see a well-executed and kind of realistic within a fantasy setting depiction of female characters compared to some of the stuff that is going on nowadays, where it's just basically women.
Oh, I agree.
But the character could be a man and nothing would change.
Yeah, no, I do agree with that. And it's actually something that I'm finding, because I'm I'm in all the Hobb threads, is that new or younger readers reading Hobb are finding it quite confrontational to read a book where the women are put at risk by nature of being women, because there aren't a lot of books that really talk about it. And so live ships can be very triggering for a lot of female readers, because it does address a lot of assault issues. There's a lot of trauma that goes on. And yet it feels more real to me that those, I mean, those risks are real. Those risks exist in our world today. These aren't things that have gone away with time. These are still present in our society. So, yeah, talk about them. And she does. She doesn't shy away from it.
You are absolutely right. And I did a bit of watching around YouTube of, I don't know why, I think we mentioned last time, Elder Links seems to have a wider female audience than some other fantasy series. But I've seen some angry reviews of women on YouTube because of what happens to a fantasy character. Forget about all the men that get killed. That doesn't matter. Forget about, men have always been disposable, but the second a female protagonist goes through some ordeal, I don't like that word, but you know the whole trigger. They're triggered people about what happens to a fantasy character because it's a woman.
And, I actually think that the anger comes from the fact that it is actually really well written. I have my own history and baggage, so I completely understand why it's triggering, because it is as real as you're ever going to read. So there's a sense that if you're going to be that real, please put in some justice. Please, you know, have the bad guy get punished. Have the consequences be serious. And yet that is as false as making women safe on a sailing ship. There aren't always consequences. And sometimes people who have been assaulted don't get justice, and they don't get the response that they wish for from the people around them. And that, I think, more than the actual assault on the character, is what is so triggering for a lot of women who read it. They're like, why would you include that if we don't get the satisfaction of seeing punishment? And again, to my mind, that makes it more realistic. This makes it more, I don't know, valid to read. And just in the last, what time are we? In the last 12 hours, I've spoken to somebody in another live stream, from Pete, from Ponderings of Pete. And obviously he isn't a woman. He hasn't experienced this. And I asked him, did that help you in understanding why this upsets women? And I think he is the audience that Robin Hobb has written that for. It's like, this is actually what is going on with the women in your life, because this happens. Learn from this. So, and I think as writers, that's what authors do, is they kind of give you a situation to think about. That's kind of the point. So I get the response, the trigger, the anger, I get it. But I do think it's there deliberately for many of those reasons.
Yeah, I never see people angry when men get killed or tortured or whatever. In fact, and then when I saw this, like, oh, all right, it's one of those things. But anyway, but I totally take your point, and I understand. And obviously, she always strikes a chord whenever she gets intense or emotional with whichever of her characters. Because even later on in the other trilogies and series, she does it all the time. But going back to the whole antagonist thing, to my mind, we can discuss here. There's only one antagonist, because we've got, is it Kefria's husband?
Kefria's husband, Kyle,
right, which to me is the, unfortunately, although it's the last bad antagonist that Robin Hobb wrote. He is similar to Prince
Regal
in that he does evil for the sake of evil and therefore makes stupid decisions because he's the bad guy. So he needs to do bad things, even though everyone can clearly see it's the wrong thing to do.
I actually think he was given a far greater grounding in that you're getting a cultural understanding of why he behaves the way he does and why his beliefs are the way they are. I found him to be really realistic and is why I hate him so much. I want to throw that character into the sun. He should. I really hate him.
I think she got much better at doing that antagonist, for example, in Rainwild Chronicles, because we have a similar character who is also the husband of our, but in Rainwilds, it's like, okay, the way he's behaving and the way he's doing things makes sense to me, even though they are evil things. There's a much better reasoning and arguing behind that. Than in Liveship. I still found that antagonist in Liveship a bit too cartoonish.
Because I've met Kyles. Kyles exist. They exist.
No. I'm not. You know, I just didn't find that believable. Whereas I think the sort of the equivalent evil husband in Rain Wilds, I found much more believable.
That's really because I'm the opposite. I find Hest to be more moustache twirly and less
interesting.
Reality based. Whereas, like I said, I've met Kyle. Kyle is in many women's lives, and I think that's why he gets the reaction that he does. Because I don't think I've ever met. Just trying to think. I can't think of a single person I've interacted with, a single woman I've interacted with, who didn't hate Kyle because they know a Kyle.
Right.
Kyle exists, and we all want to throw him into the sun. And yet, he is almost a nothing villain. Really, in the scheme of things, because by the time we get into it, we get Kennet and we get Cosgo, who are far more broadly reaching in their evilness. but they're not as real, so they don't get the same visceral reaction as Kyle.
Whereas I don't know if I would argue all the way that Kennet. Yeah, I mean, obviously, he ends up being and doing the most evil thing there. But he's kind of like begins off at least like a likable rogue / anti-hero. Oh, yeah. And it's not until kind of that moment when you have to stop liking him. But to begin with,
a lot of people aren't sure how to feel about him. They're like, he isn't very nice in his mind, but what he's doing is kind of great.
He's a bit
should I like him?
he's almost similar. This sort of Jack Sparrow figure thing. He's like the likable rogue and likable outlaw until.
And a lot of people, and myself included, my first time through, read him and go, oh, this is totally a redemption arc. You know, he's getting opportunities to better himself. And it's only as you hit that final book that you realize that he's actually choosing not to redeem himself, in that every action he's taken where he could have done something better, he's deliberately not chosen that route. And then there comes a point where you go, I'm dreaming. This guy is irredeemable. He's so damaged. And of course, you then learn about his damage. But when I read it the first time, I felt as betrayed as a reader. I was like, no, you were supposed to turn into the hero I could think was fabulous. You weren't supposed to own being a villain. But he did.
Yeah.
That was kind of impressive. I wasn't expecting it.
And again, I think that's another example of Hobb's fantastic character work. You know, she takes you on this journey where, you know, you like the bad guy or whatever, but then she does hit you with that surprise at the end. And, but, you know,
and here's the thing, is when you look at it, it's not surprising. When you look at it, it's being signposted from the beginning. He's doing nothing out of character. You've just been hoping for him not to do this.
Yeah, that's right.
He does. And the way that she wrote him is just genius, because you are genuinely thinking, he's not going to do that.
My next video coming out next week, I was talking about originality in fantasy, mm-hmm. whatever. I'm talking about the Jungian archetypes and how mm-hmm. maybe originality can come from subverting those Jungian archetypes. And maybe this is an example of, like you said, you want it to be a redemption arc. You want it to really be someone that is operating from outside of the law, but for a good cause.
Yeah.
And, you know, kind of this Robin Hood type, but it's not. Okay. All right. So, no.
And that's how it feels. It's like, oh. It's like, come on, we're going to get this. We're not.
Yeah.
It's a very sad kind of moment, because not only are you dealing with the trauma and devastation that's happening in the story, but as a reader, you have to take that disappointment that, oh, I'm not going to get the outcome I thought for this character. And that's almost a completely separate trauma to what's happening in the book, and feeds into the anger at the character because he didn't do what he was supposed to.
That's right.
So
another character that, well, I think the only character I truly, so it was, I didn't like Geoffrey's husband. I thought, like I said, it wasn't that well-written antagonist. But the one I positively wanted to metaphorically smack around was Malta.
Everybody hates Malta at the beginning.
Anyway, but again, talk about archetypes. It is that girl who's just, you know, infatuated with material, sort of rich girl, material things, and being.
She's daddy's spoiled little rich girl. And
a socialite in complete contrast with Althea and stuff like that. And I don't quite remember whether we get a bit of a redemption for her or not.
I mean, Malta undergoes a huge transformation, and she does go from that spoilt little rich girl into understanding what's real and almost completely shedding the materialistic side of things, where she kind of goes, I've learnt what's important and that I'm going to fight for. And when she makes that shift in her brain, she becomes a character that you are absolutely rooting for. You're like, yes, go be that same bitch that you've been to this point, but now pointed in the right direction. Take that willfulness, take that grit in your character, and push for the things that need to happen. And she does. And almost universally, everybody hates Malta at the beginning. And at the end of the trilogy is going, I didn't think that was possible, but she's now my favorite character.
Because she has
that massive change throughout the trilogy. And she reminds me of Scarlett O'Hara in the same way that, because she has nothing to worry about at the beginning of the story, she's flighty, has no sense of reality, but by the end of the story has found a strength within herself and is just going to do what needs doing. And Malta has found that within herself. And she's a highly admirable character by the end.
Yeah.
Who would have thought when you first met her, you're just going to shake her because she's so annoying.
And I think the bits of the books that had to deal with her, I kind of just wanted to read through them as quickly as possible and get back to anyone else. And anyone else, was doing for me, because I could not stand. I could not stand it. It just like, yeah, nothing.
Yeah, she was hard work the first time through.
I suppose also being a teacher, like
you will have dealt with that part of her personality.
Don't have patience for kids like that. It's like, no, come on. It's just, you know, we're here to get things done, and yeah, is that.
I hadn't even thought of that, but that is funny.
and particularly like my wife is also a teacher, and she's a woman, but she's sort of very championing girls and bigging girls up, and she's got zero tolerance for pansy girls. She wants girls to be,
come on, get on with it.
Yeah, come have a bit of umph about you and stuff like that. Yeah. And I just kept on imagining she's very unlikable.
Begin very unlikable.
It's absolutely remarkable. Absolutely. Another thing that I thought in Leadership Traders was better. It was very intriguing. She keeps on building the world she created. We have in a brand new location, but I think probably the more interesting new part of the world that she introduces is the Rain Wilds.
Yes.
And that bit of world building and these people that are touched by the Rain Wilds and who have got disfigurements and sort of got short lifespans and everything. It's a really interesting development.
Yeah.
Which it's explained better in Rain Wild Chronicles, isn't it?
It is. I think that's deliberate. At this point, the mystery is still there. You're getting explanations by the end of the trilogy, but there's still a great deal of mystery around it, in that they don't really grasp why they get these deformities, as to why the Rain Wilds affects them the way it does. They figure out that it does, that it is, about being in that space. And they do learn a little bit about how it's working, but they don't figure out why, and that comes later. And that mystery stays. And I think keeping that mystery around the Rain Wilds helps a lot of the story, because it leaves the mystery around a lot of the magics intact that you really don't find out about until much later, and how they're connected. Because anyone reading it will go, well, all the magic feels kind of similar. Why is it all so different when it's not? And it kind of is, but it isn't. And that sort of gets explained a little bit more with each series until you get into the final sort of arc of books that you're in now. And we start actually seeing, there is an exact reason for this in the magic. And keeping that mystery in what is still really early in the series, is necessary. You can't answer everything all at once, but you do need to give enough answers to satisfy the trilogy. And I think she balances that really well with Lifeships, really well.
Right. Now, there's one thing that with hindsight, and now we're going to really go in and properly spoil things. So the concept of the Lifeships, I think, was brilliant, right? So we've got these boats. And when the third generation captain of the boat dies on the boat, the boat comes alive. Like literally, what do you call it in English? The figurehead at the front of the boat comes alive and is sentient and all the stuff. And I thought it was a brilliant concept.
Yeah.
I really liked it. Now, let's spoil things here. The reason why that happens is because the boats are made not out of wood, but from dragon egg or sort of dead dragons inside the egg in the process of turning.
Well, they're built out of the cocoon that the dragons have made during their transition process. And the way that the process works is when they hatch, it's not so much a hatch as what would you call it? An emergence from the cocoon. And they absorb that cocoon back into themselves because they're full of memories. When the people who have discovered these cocoons, unknowing that they are cocoons, have treated it like wood and made them into ships, that material is still designed to soak up memories. So this three generations of sailors is really just what happened the first time. And they've gone, oh, that's how it works. No, it's just enough memories. About three people's lives worth will give this cocoon material enough to take on life. Unknowingly, what they've done is they've given the memories of an entire being a life without a body. And so you have a sentient being trapped in a ship.
But this is the bit that we, like, at the time I bought it all, but after reading Rainwells, I was like, hang on a second. So I don't believe that the Rainwells people found these dragon cocoons, use the shell to make boat. But inside the shell, there must have been a half dragon in the making from the
world. They do talk about that in Live Ships, in that there was something that they discarded that was inside the wood. And they don't talk about it, in that they believed those things that were inside the wood were dead, and thought that by doing so they were doing no harm, that was already dead. And only later have they really realized that no, some of them were alive, because those people that we thought were going insane talking to things were actually talking to the things that were inside the wizard wood. So it is, and this is the trick with Robin Hobb, and I have an advantage, not everybody reads it multiple times. So it's easy to miss, but it is there. Almost everything is there, and whether you catch it or not, in this instance, that was in there, and almost adds to the unfairness of it, because there did come a point where there were multiple wizard logs, cocoons left, that they continued to use for wood after knowing that what they were doing was harvesting a living thing's cocoon. So then it enters into the whole the value of life. Like, clearly this being that you are destroying its cocoon is alive, but you're going to make so much money from selling that cocoon as wood built into a ship that you're going to disregard the life within it. And then we enter into the whole, you know, you've just enslaved the memory of a being, a sentient being in a ship. You've created slaves from these cocoons. And that's a whole other theme that Live Ships talks about. So there's a lot in Live Ships, a lot.
That's right. And then the other thing that it took me a while to figure out is that we follow these tangles of sea serpents.
Yes.
And throughout the trilogy, like at the beginning of every other chapter or something like that, it's got nothing to do with events. And then it only makes sense at the end that these tangles of sea serpents are like sort of your first stage dragons, isn't it?
Yes.
They just hatched, and they've got lost. They've lost the memories. They don't know where to go to create these cocoons and so on.
Yep.
So throughout the whole trilogy, you're following these sea serpents, and it's down to the very end where you get the payoff, and then it all makes sense. But one thing that to me remains unexplained, and I'm on the second to last book of the whole thing, is this other's island that Captain Kennett visits, where you get some sort of prophecy or you find some mysterious object in the sand that you're allowed to take with you. It's not really well explained. Doesn't say what these other people are. And I am 3, 4, 7, 8 books later, and that still remains a mystery. I'm hoping it is explained in the last trilogy.
But you did get some of it in Rain Wilds, which obviously I'm not going to spoil here. And the other's island does still have just some magic about it. As to how these items arrive on the beach, you never really learn. But they're there, because I know you're only in the first book of the last trilogy, so you there are still things that you will discover about Other's Island. So I can't really tell you, say that there are still things to learn about it.
Because to me, there is that, I don't know, it seems like a very important part, and it's not explained at all in Lifeship. Is this place?
No, it's just a place of weirdness.
Yeah.
Where they'd captured and trapped this particular serpent, refused to let it go. Oh, thank you, Stacey. but they've trapped the she who remembers. They've trapped her. We don't find out why until later. That is something that will come.
Right.
And from there, you can sort of deduce some things, but you sort of aren't sure. But it is very much an island of mystery that is left unsolved during Lifeship Traders. It is a place of magic. It is a place of odd, weird things. And that just, we're going to leave that there to puzzle you until later.
That bear, I'll be very annoyed if that is not explained, because it seemed very sort of fairly pivotal to the story. And I don't like some sort of, there you go, your fan club is cheering you, Derry. I don't like any kind of Deus Ex Machina devices to get me to move the plot forward. It's like, I'm just gonna have this.
It's just magic.
Island. Yeah. No. That's just not.
No. And this is something that a lot of readers do get stuck on. It's like, well, that just seemed to come out of nowhere. And again, I have to remember that not everybody has read it a million times and has missed some of the things that have been dropped along the way. Everything has been there since the beginning. So when something shows up out of nowhere, it hasn't shown up out of nowhere. It either pre-existed and you just don't know about it yet, or its influence has been felt and you don't know the connection yet. But nothing has been created full cloth to just move the plot along. Everything existed from the beginning. And their influence, the things that they can do that you learn about, should you reread, you will see that those things have been happening for some time. So it can read like the Deus Ex Machina, where you're like, that was convenient.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was, but she built it in right at the beginning.
The things that I've grown to trust Robin Hobb as I've been reading the series. So I said, I'm hoping that all that will be addressed.
Maybe
for the first time reader, that could be a bit, like I said, very convenient plot device.
I think part of it is that even though the series is called Realm of the Elderlings, it's very easy to forget when you're reading the books to look for the story of the elderlings within the plots that you're being given. So there's a lot being done about the elderlings all the way through all of the books that you just don't register until much later. And then you go, What?
I'll put my hand up and own up to that. I think I probably missed it, but in the feats and the in Farcia and Tauniman, there is little to no reference to the other links, but I could have missed it. So I'm still waiting for the link between feats and the full to the other links.
Yeah.
Go on. No,
because you're reading Fits in the Fall, I'm like, I don't want to spoil that.
Okay, hold on.
What I will say there then is for the Elderlings thing, the realm of the Elderlings, for the most part, in almost all of these books, the mystery is where did they go? What are they? Where did they go? What happened to them? Fits in the Fall's arcs that we've had through Farcia, through Tauniman, and you're about to get in Fits in the Fall, are showing you how they are unearthing what was done and reversing it. So the things that they've done in Farcia and the things that they've done in Tauniman have worked against the things that have been keeping the Elderlings gone. Yeah. I can say that it's not a spoiler. So it's there that the Elderling story is there. It's just sitting under that main plot, in that what they're doing is doing two things. It's moving their own plot along, and it's working against something that they don't know they're working against yet. You will find very soon you will encounter that force they're working against. And for the first time in the final trilogy, they're actually working directly against those forces. So that story has been going since the beginning. You're just unaware of it. Hindsight will have you go. Yeah. Hindsight will have you going, oh, that's, yeah.
Because I think you were being very cryptic at the beginning of the stream today about that they were doing kind of going off on the wrong search in Farcia. Basically what we have in Farcia is that they are looking for, I think, I can't remember now, but they were looking for sort of ancient protectors of the realm, and they end up
went looking for Elderlings.
They end up invoking these fake dragons, so to speak, that they animate from stone. Whereas in Lifeship Traders, they actually end up gaining the favor and protection of actual real dragons. Have that sort of...
And we learn with Malta and Rain what the Elderlings were in terms of it's the proximity to dragons that give you that elongated lifespan. And that elongated lifespan helps those individuals become so entrenched in the magic that they can do wondrous things. It's not that they are inherently more magical, it's simply that they so long lived, they find ways to use that magic in ways that ordinarily wouldn't have been discovered. So if you read Lifeships first and you meet Malta and Rain as they become the first Elderlings in millennia, you meet a real dragon. To watch Verity go on a quest for Elderlings, you know, is a redundant mission, because you know there have been no Elderlings until Lifeships. So you know he's on a mission to nothing. When you find Verity in the quarry and he's making a stone dragon, you know that there are real dragons. So what is the point of a stone dragon? It takes away so much value from Farcia because the memory stone is so important, which you learn in later series, that the order that you learn things in is important. You have to learn what forging is before you learn about the memory cocoons. You have to learn what forging is and the way it alters humanity before you meet Kennet and how that interacts. those things that can only work in that way, in that order, by finding it out in that order. The magics and fits. Robin Hobb is a genius. Those little epigraphs that you get at the beginning of each chapter are so incredibly valuable.
Yes.
Because a lot of the story hints are in them. And very, very early on, Fitz makes the connection that is really only explained in this final trilogy that you're in now. We kind of got closer to it with Verity as he found the quarry. We kind of got closer to it in Live Ships when we learn about the Rainwilds. But he made that connection in a guess very early. And that payoff isn't here for you. You still have that to come. But that's how interconnected the series is, that she has given you all of these clues all the way through, that this is how it works. She hasn't hidden anything. She's gone, all of the information is there. Nobody's put it together in world or as a reader, but it's all there. You get enough information, it will go, it all makes sense.
This is why talking to you is so great, because now it's all making a lot more sense for me now. And I'm just wondering whether, you know, how am I reading books to miss all these things? Then again, I don't know, how many times have you read the series?
A lot. I'm on my 23rd read through, and I'm about to start Ship of Magic. So,
okay, so, right. So I got another 22 rereads to catch up with you.
And not everybody has time or the energy to read these many books this many times. I mean, that's ridiculous. So why shouldn't I share the fact that I have read it this many times and I have caught almost, I think, hopefully by now, all of these little things that are in all the books? Because they are. It's astonishing.
And more to think about, when you realize that she wrote the first trilogy without having in mind everything that was going to come afterwards. It was just...
Yeah.
I don't know if... I think Fassia was her first sort of published work.
As Robin Hobb, it was right. Robin Hobb's. She'd written quite a lot as Megan Lindholm, and she still writes under Megan Lindholm as well. That pen name tends to write slightly less dense fantasy. It's a little lighter. She writes a little bit of urban fantasy under Megan Lindholm, and it's really only the big grand scale epic things that she writes as Robin Hobb. But it was the first thing that came out under the name Robin Hobb, deliberately a gender neutral name, and it did phenomenally well for its time. But she wrote it in the early 90s. The final book, Assassin's Fate, didn't come out until 2017, I think.
17 or 18, yeah.
Yeah, that's a big window. It's over 20 years.
And I remember the last book coming out because I was still living in London.
Yeah.
And I was aware that Robin Hobb existed, but right. I hadn't started reading Elderlings yet.
Okay. Yeah.
And she came to London to my favorite fantasy and comic book store to do a book signing. And I was wondering, should I go? But I haven't read any of the other books. And she was coming to sign the last one. And I'm
Please
not
tell
excited.
Me you went.
Well, let me tell you. So this book's got two levels. You've got ground floor and then the basement. Right.
Oh, so I know where you mean. Yeah. Lonely Planet.
Forbidden Planet.
Forbidden Planet. Yeah, I've been there.
Right. So Forbidden Planet, all the book signings are in the basement, right?
Oh, my God. Really?
Okay. The queue for Robin Hobb book signing.
That would have been immense.
It started at the basement, went up the stairs, out of the shop, and down and round the corner of the building. I didn't go. It's one I regret now. Yeah. But I didn't know
what you don't know.
I didn't know better at the time. No. That's right. Otherwise, I would have been there because I've been to many book signings at Forbidden Planet, yeah. and that's one yeah. I, yeah, anyway.
Wow. But it doesn't surprise me at all. I had the book on pre-order. I had the day following because obviously it comes out overnight and it will just arrive on my Kindle. So yeah, yeah. I had the following day booked off work. There was no way I was going to work. I ended up ringing my boss halfway through the day saying I'm not going to be in tomorrow either because I was like, no, I'm already an emotional mess. I'm going to need recovery time.
Yeah.
And, like, it was a big deal for me. I still get like, I always remember its release because I get it on my Facebook notifications and my memories as I'm getting more and more excited about the book coming.
Well,
only three more days.
Let's try. That's so funny. Let's try to not end up you and I crying again like we did last time.
We can do it.
In
we
the last trip. Yeah, let's try to keep it together. Right, let's go. I think this is super spoilery and probably. But anyway, so we have this character, I can't remember her name, but I'm sure you do, the handicraft lady
Amber.
In Nightship Traders, right?
Yeah,
wasn't it? Right. Can we say who she really is? Is that appropriate at this stage?
I think at this stage, given that we've already done some fairly big spoilers, and we're talking now about the fact that this is going to be a spoiler, so if you don't want to know about Amber, bugger off.
We could not say who she really is, but it totally. We can say I totally did not clock on who she really is.
Did you click? When did you click?
Until I got told in Towny Man.
Okay. Wow. That's. It's not unique at all. There are other readers who didn't click at all.
Because I know you mentioned last time that when she carves the face of the Paragon. Figurehead of the...
Yeah.
But I didn't clock on that she carves Fitz's face. There, or maybe I'm just not... No, because I don't have the recollection of having that insight. So, okay, yeah. Hang on, because... is Shadia wowing at my incompetence as a reader?
You aren't the only one. You aren't the only one.
Sorry as well. So, okay, clearly more on me.
You aren't alone at all. There are a lot of, again, with hindsight, if you ever revisit the series, you are going to kick yourself around the block because you'll be like, how did I miss that? How?
Yeah.
Maybe. Because it is in every single interaction that Amber has. She literally says the words, I have been called a fool and will do again. She. There are so many. She talks about how prophets are going to work as toy makers. And there are just so many little throwaway lines that she gives. A lot of people click at the moment where she's giving Althea lessons in how to move like a man. For some, it's when she shows a skill in transforming herself from a slave to a servant to a young boy. People are like, oh, she can shift her appearance quite easily. And she's good at acting in different ways. And when you add that to the discussions that we had with Starling in particular at the end of Farseer, who talks about the fool being a woman, and we're getting that gender neutral, gender fluid discussion around the fool, when you add that in to the information you get about Amber, for a lot of people, it only takes a handful of clues. But there are absolutely people like yourself who get to the end of it and haven't cottoned. Until you get the discussion later in Tawny Man. But you aren't alone. You absolutely aren't alone.
Yeah, but I'm getting vibes of there's two types of people in the world. The ones that realize who Amber is and the ones that don't. And I am in the latter category.
Maybe not two kinds of people, but in you I'm I feel mean saying it, but you are in the minority in that.
Excellent.
It's a small group of readers that haven't clicked. Usually what I found is, and this may be true for you, you can tell me if I'm wrong, is you've got a different idea in your head about who Amber is, and are working on a different theory and waiting for her to fall into that theory rather than seeing what's actually been put in front of you. So
possibly, I don't know, maybe I don't pay that much attention to what I'm reading or how I'm reading it. it's true. Maybe, you know, I'm just reading the books. Like you said before, maybe I'm just too engrossed in the story I am being told. And, you know, it's called Realm of the Elderlings. And what the hell does Lifeship Traders got to do with the Elderlings? Or what, you know, my first year, maybe a little bit. So maybe I'm just, I just thought she was
Amber.
Nothing.
But this is a valid thing. And Hobb is, and this is, I think, why she is such a good writer, because you can read it as a story and just allow everybody to be how they're presented to you, and it's a really good story. Or you can read it and go, this is Robin Hobb, so there's that story and there's this story that's sitting underneath it that's a greater story, and sometimes both are visible and you can infer from one and the other and you can find the connective tissue, but not always. And I absolutely have the advantage over many, many readers in having read it as much as I have. But it means hopefully I can save some people some reading time and give you some of that connective tissue and sort of say, look for this kind of thing. Think about this. Keep this in mind because that's important. And hopefully enrich that reading experience for somebody who maybe isn't going to read it twice, but now can get that little bit more out of that first read. And for Amber, I thought that the connective tissue there with the deeper story was quite strong with just that character. But it isn't blatant. I mean, it's fairly there. But she's not sort of stamping up and down and going, notice this. It's there if you're looking. If you're looking for a bit more, it's there. But if you're not, it doesn't change the story. The story of Lifeships remains the story of Lifeships. It doesn't change anything. And you do get informed of it when it's necessary in the later book. So, yeah.
You're absolutely right, but I suppose this is the great thing about being able to discuss books with people and sort of, you know, get a different perspective on things. Yeah. If we weren't here discussing it, you know, we're just being happy thinking that...
that's all there is.
But yeah, that's where it was, and that was it.
So with not figuring out that Amber was the fool, how did the final chapter for you make sense? Because they find the treasure hoard, because they do take Paragon to the treasure hoard of the pirate who had him many years earlier, and Amber finds the rooster crown that Fitz and Fool saw and dreamt at the end in Assassin's Quest, when they had the vision of the Fool wearing the rooster crown. How did that final scene work for you without that connective?
But it doesn't, I suppose. You just, which, obviously, the thing is that I read Lifeship like a couple of years ago, but now that you mentioned that, another moment. So that explains... No, but that explains why the Fool has got all the money and he's Lord Golden in Towniman.
Yeah, absolutely.
It all makes sense. Some stories are... Okay, Shadia, there's no need to point it out. Just sometimes... Sometimes it's okay to do, you know, I know this, yeah.
But this is the joy of it, because it doesn't take away from the story, whether you got that or not. It was still a really good trilogy, and it still stands on its merits.
No, but
you know,
but
it then, worked.
But then when I come to do, because I'll eventually do like a final overall review of the whole Elderlings.
Yeah.
It helps to if I want to give someone an spoiler-free sort of overall view of the series, it's good to have all these things in place. So one final thing that I thought about, but probably the whole series, but is the way she treats dragons, or the consequences of having dragons in this world. Because in more classic fantasy, sometimes the dragons are just a glorified horse for the hero to ride into battle and that sort of thing. Whereas, quite logically, Robin Hood thought, okay, if I'm going to have these super intelligent, magically capable creatures who can instill fear in people just by their soul presence and da-da-da-da-da, they're never going to let a human ride them and so on. And they would probably think that every other form of life is just there to serve them and to do with as they please. And that's like, absolutely, that's the logical. I think it's the first fantasy author where I've seen use dragons in that, and take it to the logical.
As a separate species, as a separate, as you say, highly intelligent species. And by giving them wings, she's kind of got rid of the human tendency to form boundaries. She's gone, no, they're dragons. Everywhere is theirs. They can get everywhere. They're going to, in their own thought process, everywhere is under their control. Because why not? They're stronger than everything. They're smarter than everything. Everything out there, they can kill and eat. So they're totally in charge of the whole world. And I love that they even acknowledge it when, you know, Fool gets asked, what are you bringing back into the world? Why would you do this? And Fool goes, because humanity needs to be reminded that, no, it isn't their world and they're just a part of it. And I loved that so much. That she gave dragons not only loads of abilities, but also gave them control over their own sphere. Because as you say, rightly, they're so often just flying horses, you know, or they're in some way connected to humanity and reliant on them somehow. So, yeah, I really liked the independence of Robin Hobb's dragons. I thought they were fabulous. And the arrogance in them is just, oh, I love it. It's so good.
I suppose, now thinking about it, the other author that kind of did something similar would have been Tolkien in The Hobbit, where the dragon's mouth, he just took control of everything. He just so happened to be sleeping for so many years, but he did take over that whole part of the world and treat it as his.
Because he could.
That's right. Yep. I think to me that made perfect sense. But then it makes me wonder if throughout the series they are bringing more and more dragons into the world, that kind of have a happy ending. Like, you know.
Well, it could go horribly wrong. We all know this. But we also have to consider, with events of the live ships and what we learn about the way dragon memory works, is at that cocooning stage, they share memories because they're helped by other dragons. We're going to now have an entire generation of dragons who, as part of their communal memory, have the fact that their very existence has humanity to thank. That humanity brought them back from the brink when they kind of didn't have to. So I think that will have a an effect. I think that will alter to some degree how the dragons interact with humanity. And with each successive generation, that will actually bring humanity and dragons closer together in understanding. I still think they're going to be horrifically arrogant. I still think they're going to be tremendously dangerous. But I do think there would be, with each successive generation that does interact with humanity, a little more respect of humanity. With that awareness, and because the memories don't get lost of how much they owe humanity in bringing them back from extinction.
And of course, we get a lot of that later on in Rain Wilds. That's when we get all of that.
We get that more interaction, and we get more of how the memories work. So it could still go horribly wrong. Let's not get that wrong. But I do think that it's likely to be less harmful to humanity than it could have been.
Yeah.
So.
Right. I think there's probably other things I had sort of knocking about in my head, and I think we've covered sort of everything. But if you've got, you know, something else that you want to mention that I may have missed, or something else to highlight on the series that we haven't really talked about,
story and plot wise, I think we've covered quite a lot. I think probably the only theme we haven't really talked about would be the trauma that we deal with a lot in Lifeships. Lifeships is probably the most confronting series in that regard, because we're dealing with trauma not only from the female characters, but we're dealing with trauma with Kennet, we're dealing with trauma with Paragon, with Wintrow, even with Kyle to some degree, and how that informs decision making, and how that informs future interactions, and all of the differing ways people deal with trauma. And I think that Robin Hobb dealt with that in an extremely deft way. I think she dealt with it very respectfully. I think it made for a very meaningful read when it could have been an adventure. It could just have been an adventure. It could just have been dragons and pirates and all of these things and been fabulous. But it actually really took itself seriously and went, this is actually how people live. This is how we live with each other. This is how we interact. These are the things we cause in each other. And I think that look at humanity is just as valuable as getting this wonderfully rich story that includes serpents and dragons and magical talking ships and pirates. And I think that just gives it so much weight as a series. And I think it's why, as a standalone trilogy, it works so fantastically well, and that it gives all of Realm of the Elderlings a significant chunk of its value to literature, because it does talk about some serious things.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, each of the sort of self-contained trilogies has got some really profound, deep thematic elements about them that goes beyond simply storytelling. And we talked about it last time. We're not going to call Robin Hobb grimdark, but she does not shy away from putting her characters through ordeals, whoever they are. But they don't feel gratuitous. Things happen for a reason, and they have consequences. And, if she needs to do X, Y, or Z to A, B, or C character, it is going to happen, and she doesn't shy away. It's kind of, I don't want to say matter-of-factly, but, you know, it's just something else that could happen to you. It's not just a fantasy story. It's not just...
But it is kind of matter-of-fact. It's like these things happen to people, and people still have to get up in the morning and have food and gather wood and make fire. You still have to get up and get on with it. And for anyone with mental health issues, that's a remarkably important message that, these things happen and they're really hard and they're really traumatic. Still got to get up in the morning. Still got to put one foot in front of the other, because you're not going to get anywhere if you don't. Keep going. And reading that sort of, that matter-of-factness about it, that taking away any kind of, I don't know, wokeness, deliberateness about it, makes it easier to take, because it's just there. We're not going to make a big deal about it. This is just a thing that happened that now we have to get over.
So, you know? Now that you mentioned that, I hate the whole woke thing. So, could these books have been written in 2022, 2023, 2024? The way things are going? Or could she have got away because she's a woman?
Ooh, careful there. I think that she's grown enough as a writer that should she have written them now, most of it would be the same, because the story is still the story. I think, if anything, we would simply see a greater acceptance of the fool's gender fluid nature. I think that's we true. Might have seen a greater acceptance of any kind of non-traditional sexual relationship, because they're there in the books as well. Yeah, yeah. They're very hidden, and they're treated in a way that wouldn't be how they're treated now. And those are perhaps the things I think that she would change now if she wrote them now. But I think the story would remain the same. I do think that. And for Liveships in particular, I think she could write that still unchanged. It would still work, because it does still work.
No, absolutely. And I'm very glad that the books are written the way they are, because talking about obviously all the issues of gender fluidity, homosexuality, all the sort of that is still to come in later books. I think, again, it's kind of matter of factly. You know, yeah. It happens. We have
it's in our world. It's there.
And the fact that, but equally, it's not tokenistic. She's not trying to tick a box to say, oh, here I have a homosexual couple. Look how cool a writer I am. No. She would write in a homosexual couple, and she'll make them go through the issues that they would face because of being homosexual and address it.
Or in the book. It wouldn't be a factor at all, and you wouldn't even notice they're a homosexual couple until somebody mentions it later. And you go, oh, that's right. They totally were a homosexual couple. But it's not made a big deal of, because it's not important. It's not the thing that was valid about the story. And I think that's where she gets a lot of the strength in her writing. She doesn't highlight things that don't need highlighting. She doesn't announce things for the point of, for just to say, look, I wrote that. Aren't I, you know, widely read? Aren't I clever? Aren't I woke? I don't like the word either, but it does explain what I mean. And in doing so, it just makes it all that much easier to read and to swallow and to accept as a story, because being around people who want to do that in real life is energy draining. You're just like, okay, we get it. You're accepting. You're a good person. You don't have to tell everybody about it. So, yeah, I think that that's definitely a strength in her writing. Absolutely.
Right. I think that with that, we kind of reach the end of this particular conversation. Hopefully, it will not be the last one that we have. I would love to continue doing a chat for each one of the self-contained stories. So we'll try to arrange a date for Townie Man, which will be the next one. And we'll figure out a date and a time that suits everyone, and anyone that wants to join in on that conversation that wasn't here today, anyone is more than welcome.
You please do.
So thank you very much, Shadia and Stacey, who have been watching throughout, and anyone that is going to be watching later. Derry, as usual, It's an absolute pleasure talking to you about Realm of the Otherlings, and I'm really looking forward to next time.
Absolutely. I am also. Thank you again for having me. I appreciate it very much.
No. I wish we could do more of this. Brilliant. And with that, we'll say goodbye and we'll see you soon. Take care, everyone. Bye.
Thank you.